Hi, and welcome back to another episode of In Our Tech Society, with this new season all about changing worlds of work. It's often said that the oil of the 21st century is data, in the sense that it's what powers economic growth and technological development, hopefully without the catastrophic climate impacts, although that's a discussion for a different episode. That scramble for data, of course, affects work, and brings with it ever-growing surveillance and quantification. It's a long-running trend, but we saw an even greater upsurge during the pandemic. Here's Ashlyn Kelly-Lythe, who longtime listeners will remember from our first episode in Series 1 on algorithmic management.
And we've seen, in particular for office workers, a big increase in the use of monitoring tools since the beginning of the pandemic. So just to give you some figures on this, there's been some research that 16% of US companies put new tracking software into their employees' laptops when they went remote in the first month of the pandemic.
Ashlyn was talking about office jobs specifically here, but there is increasing quantification and tracking of other kinds of jobs too, like factory work. There's a lot of nuance and complexity in this topic, because quantification raises questions of economics, management, labour law, and also what it means for the autonomy and identity of people if they are constantly tracked. Fortunately, my guest today has written extensively on all of those topics. Here's Dr. Phoebe Moore. I'll let her introduce herself.
Thank you very much, Paddy. I appreciate you inviting me to do this podcast. I am a professor of management and the futures of work at the University of Essex. And I'm also working as a senior policy researcher at the International Labour Organization in the research department. And I'm someone who's been working on the topics that are most important, I think, for work and the world of work, as well as industrial relations. And I look specifically at technology in the workplace and the way that it affects the world of work and also working conditions and workers.
So you've written a book, and a lot of your work is kind of under this label of the idea of the quantified self. What motivated you to write that book, firstly, and what's it basically about?
Well, I think one of the biggest questions of our time, and something that's also been central to philosophy, to Western philosophy, as well as Eastern philosophy, is the concept of the self. And I've been interested in identifying how various features of modern life then become part of how people are able to achieve selfhood, and, or able to express selfhood, or able to simply be. And I'm not going to be able to say enough in kind of the 5 or 10 minutes here, but when I started to become aware of the ways that people in wellness and self-empowerment circles had started to use tracking devices. So they'd started to use technological tools to identify themselves, as it were. So you've got the quantified self movement. This is a movement that comes out of California in around 2010 and thereabouts. And what the quantified self movement is about is, again, it's a kind of a self-optimization wellness type of social movement, as it were, for individuals who started to say, well, you know, there are ways that I can track myself, my movements, maybe even my dreams. I can track aspects of my behavior or to do it, or my experiences in ways that then allow me to know, quote unquote, the self that is not otherwise knowable. And this became, when I came across this group, I started to think, okay, so there's this achievement goal, this kind of incentive around using technological tools and their related quantification, numeration, and measurement processes in order to derive some self-fulfillment and meaning. And so I thought, well, you know, there's something to this. And then when I started to look at the different arenas where people were self-tracking, and obviously we've got already in hospitals and the medical profession where, you know, stethoscopes and other forms of tracking technologies are vital and a part and parcel to human, if effectively human life. And then those kinds of technologies begin to diversify and go move into other spaces. So you've got again, in the wellness Silicon Valley style quantified self movement, people were tracking their running, their steps, you know, I've already mentioned, so their sleep and all these elements for their day-to-day lives to look for patterns across time. So if there's a longitudinal set of data, which comes from, for example, my running, so I can then, so people would look at that within the quantified self movement as an example within wellness and say, okay, so I feel better. You can make cross checks. You can say, well, if I'm doing more running during the week and I can identify the data to demonstrate that, then I can extrapolate from that to make decisions about then how do I feel, or maybe I can cross check against other measurements of, let's say, stress, let's say productivity. Then, and the productivity question matters, because then when you move away from this more gym-based or you know, self-optimizing in other senses space and move into the workplace, then of course there are different connotations. So there have been tracking technologies used in factories and warehouses for decades, and of course scientific management. So one of Frederick W. Taylor's, so what he's sort of known for is that he used early cameras to take photographs of people's movements to identify in the factory space or in the steelmaking environment to identify what the one best way for the productive body would be. So again, there's this technological dimension that goes as far back as the interwar period. So this kind of trend where there's an acceleration more recently of the uptake of different algorithmic management tools in workplaces that also were coming out of the space of the self-empowerment and the gym and the self and the quantified self movements, where you have initiatives in office spaces as well, where self-tracking becomes something related to work. Then I started to ask the question, what will this mean in terms of being and people's identification of the self and other things? And that also has to do with understanding of being in a collective environment. So, you know, does quantification become a highly individualizing method for self-awareness? So those are the types of questions that I've asked in my quantified self research. And it's something that still is very, very much of interest for me today.
Obviously, the company that employs the workers gets a load of data about their productivity from tracking and quantifying their work. The basic idea then is that you can take that data and an algorithm can be either used to inform management decisions made by humans or can itself just be used to manage humans directly. So what that looks like is that you feed a load of data about productivity indicators into an algorithm. The algorithm takes those inputs and decides some person's productivity level and probably ranking compared to other workers in terms of that productivity. And then either a human sees that and takes some decision like firing them, promoting them, etc. Or the algorithm itself could, if you like, take the decision if its recommendation is just automatically put into practice.
One of the arguments I've made is that the introduction of technology into the workplace, as though technology itself holds some form of subjectivity because it is used for making decisions, but of course it itself isn't technically making the types of decisions that we as humans make. Nevertheless, the technology is treated as though it has the competence akin to a human. And one of the ways that I could identify this is a case study recently that I've written about with some colleagues, that what we're arguing in looking at a case study that occurred in Portugal is that a company made a decision to restructure, and it came out in commercial media in the news that in fact this company was going to use an algorithm to make the decisions for how to restructure and who to lay off. So workers found out about this, and they found out about their imminent restructuring in social media domain. So that first start is something that begins to look like there's a question mark around the employment relationship, because where's transparency? Where's that dialogue? You know, where's the kind of negotiation process? So that was the first thing that occurred. Next things that start to occur is that that workers were asked to go and to speak to their management, to bosses. And the algorithm that allegedly was used to make decisions was never clearly revealed. And so the question mark emerged, is there even an algorithm at all? So this brings into into sort of sharp relief. This concept around the technology or the machine in the workplace is having its own supposed subjective positioning that is dealt with in a way that looks like we're actually objectifying, we're actually subjectifying, we're actually saying that the decision-making competences are the same level as humans. And so what are we doing when we create this kind of environment with a phantom algorithm? So again, all the features within the employment relationship that are already under some form of duress to do with privacy, trust, accountability, potentials for discrimination, are, I would say, exacerbated in these moments whereby we, because of our immense capacity for symbolic reasoning, can introduce another actor into the employment relationship, which is the machine. And we can give it the qualities of a human to the extent that we are saying our decisions are made because of said machine. And then, of course, this is leaked to the press. Workers find out. Workers are then brought into discussions. And again, the cases are still ongoing. This is a real case. It's in court now and in the European courts. And the curiosity for me is to say, you know, have we got to the level now within the employment relationship and the working in the world of work whereby the phantom algorithm is considered as trustworthy as management? And if we are there, and if we do have this algorithmic boss that Jeremiah Adams Prassel talks about, if we are there, then what does that mean in terms of the future of work and the future of technology in the workplace? And I'm quite happy that it's in court, because so far there have been no grounds for reasonable decision making identified. But it's to be seen to what extent this will then stand out as a kind of a case, some case law that then could set precedent for how decisions can be made on the basis of algorithmic tools that they themselves may or may not even exist. So I think this is a really interesting moment in humanity for our, in terms of workplace and the futures of work, and something we really need to keep an eye on.
It sounds to me like the algorithm there is, it's almost like they're using it to take some of the responsibility so that the boss is going to avoid taking responsibility for a set of difficult and probably unpopular decisions that involve firing people or restructuring
the organization. Well, this is the accountability
question,
and that has been part of, you know, the tensions in the employment relationship for many years. So the potential for abstraction within quantification, which is a major part of how labor process theory talks about control in the workplace, is, you know, the kind of usage of technology exacerbates that. And so that means increasingly we're finding decision making, if it is devolved to machinic competences, then again we're getting into a situation where workers really do need protections in the form of worker representation and unions. And unions are noticing these things, and we do have discussions of digitalization and the workplace. So, yes.
Just a quick side note on trade unions. If you want to hear more about their changing role in work, we've got 3 episodes on trade unions in different parts of the world. There'll be not the next episode, but the 3 episodes after that. So make sure to subscribe to In Our Tech Society so you don't miss that. Back to this, I guess with the quantified worker, there's also this idea that your whole reliability and productivity as a worker can be easily measured and tracked just with the right set of data, which may be more true in some industries than others. And there are 2 things here. The first is that often attempts to measure output are just not very good. So certain productivity management software will mark you up for productivity the more emails you send. And I think a lot of listeners would agree that emails can often just be a distraction from the actual work that needs doing, unless your job is just to send emails. The second kind of more fundamental point, though, is that it's not necessarily just that we're using the wrong measures to measure productivity. It's not actually clear to me that you can always just measure the productivity of a certain worker that easily. There are contexts like manufacturing where you can quite easily measure output. But I'm not sure that you can track productivity based on a fixed set of data for some kinds of jobs, especially if there's a lot of teamwork involved or if it's very ideas-based, etc. What do you think?
Well, that's one of the major questions around quantification in the employment relationship and in the workplace and the world of work, because productivity, of course, has a certain set of measurements or certain set of judgments for its achievement, which are set by, you know, the core group within a company, technically within the management structure. So you'd find productivity. It of course depends on the industry. If you're looking at the, let's say, a car manufacturing situation, so let's talk about a factory. So productivity can be more, let's say, in a more straightforward way understood. And that tends to be speed, right? So speed can be linked with productivity potentially. Of course, you also have something very tangible in terms of an output, which is clearly a car. So, you know, then work. So that might be easier to cross-check workers on the shop floor, on the console, you know, working, and, you know, the speed of their work in car assembly and so on, maybe more straightforward. But when you get into the knowledge workspace, productivity clearly has different connotations. So something I think that can be weakened in the employment relationship, and that does link to trust as well, has to do with the autonomy around working habits. So if the minute a technology is introduced to make some kind of judgment about workers' productivity, I would say that could lead to very, very clear issues around trust. Now, knowledge workers, that could be, let's say, editors, that could be writers, that could be creative workers. So the work that comes out of those environments also have different dimensions around meaning and self-understanding and awareness. So there's a literature on in terms of it looking at autonomy. We've got labor process theory that looks at the kind of ways that people respond to these technologies. So self-fulfillment and meaning can come out of work itself, but that increasingly can be challenged with the use of technologies at work. So in answer to your question, productivity and its meaning must be linked to some kind of subjectivity in order for autonomy and fulfillment of workers to be achieved. And I've argued this in my work. And I would say that the increasing quantification of work challenges that and may very well restrict self-meaning at work and in the workplace.
That's interesting what you say about reduced autonomy for workers in their working habits, because we talk a lot about working from home and the sudden rise in prevalence of that with the pandemic, which to some extent has remained. But the flip side of that, of course, is that there's more tracking of workers. And leading on from that, there's this concept that you've written about called function creep in the employment relationship. What does that mean?
So this is something that informs debates around data protection and privacy and is within the general data protection regulation, which has effectively become a global standard. Now, function creep is when data that's been collected for one purpose is used for another purpose. And it's very, very hard to manage that despite it's not technically permissible within data and privacy law. So, for example, if you have been swiping in and out of work, and you know the reason for swiping in and out of work, the workplace, as it were, you have a key card, is so that how many hours you are there is known, how many hours and minutes, and so that would be your pay. That would be related to your pay. So if that data is used for another purpose altogether, management decides, look, we just want to know, you know, are people using this space? And this might sound innocuous, but, you know, if your key card is also used to go in and out of certain rooms, and for some reason management thinks, well, we want to make a decision based on how often this worker is using this room, and that could be some kind of penalty. There could be a penalty applied for usage of a room. Then that would be function creep, because it's using data which seems to be quite neutral, just simply going in and out of rooms. But then if it's used to make a decision about firing someone, then that would be a red flag for me in terms of function creep, because, you know, that would mean data is being used for other reasons. There's also something called inference, and these are very tricky subjects in data protection and privacy debates, because inferences is whereby, you know, there may be data, you may have anonymous data, you may have data where, you know, the individual is known, but if the data has been collected for a specific reason and management has a quick look at the data and there's no way of knowing that they've looked at the data, and there are inferences made about, let's say, reasons for going in and out of this room, or the inference that you know that the identity of this person based on having, let's say, knowledge of their, in general, movements around the office. So the inferences then come out of that. So decisions are made based on data that's collected for one reason, and then the inference has to do with other kinds of decisions that are made or understandings of identification and those types of problems. And that's another thing that, in fact, data law does not cover well and is something that's being debated now in terms of privacy and data protection.
And there's this term or concept that you came up with called AI trainers. Now, my understanding of that is, say you wanted to train a program to be able to recognize faces or flag inappropriate content on social media. You train the algorithm effectively on a bunch of data, and then you get somebody to go through and tell the AI where it's wrong. So maybe the AI has flagged something as a face, which is actually, I don't know, a cat or something. And then the AI trainer will correct that. And similarly, the AI might have flagged something as inappropriate, which is perfectly fine, or vice versa. And you'll have an AI trainer who will tell the AI where it's wrong, and the AI learns from this data. Could you explain that in a little bit more detail for us and what the implications of that are?
Well, AI trainers is a concept that I came up with in conversations with Jamie Woodcock, so who I do some work with, and we've published a book recently on AI augmented exploitation, artificial intelligence, automation in work. So we started to think about, in terms of the AI, if AI is a product, so to speak, and if there is a value chain for the production of such a product, then we were interested in thinking through who are the individuals, who are the workers, which groups of workers, what kinds of labor markets exist for AI to exist, because it does not simply hang suspended in midair. It does not, you know, come out of nowhere. And so when we started to think about what AI in effect is, it has to do with image recognition, has to do with text recognition. Now, these are narrow forms of AI. They are not the universal AI whereby we see a machine behaving exactly as a human, making decisions, and even inferences and subjective conceptualizations. But instead, we've got this narrow AI. You are using your smartphone when you are, you know, going into the shop, and your phone starts telling you things based on the algorithms of things that you've been saying, responsive to what you've been saying. Then actually what happens in the background are that there are teams of workers in contact centers who are doing this type of work. It's image labeling, it's annotation. So you've got actually quite skilled sometimes workers working in relatively poor conditions, often in the global south. And when we started to look into it, we thought no one is really making the argument that workers are behind a lot of this. And it's not just your own voice as a kind of a prosumer. So these are different types of theorizations, by the way, and I'm going to try to say it in as few words as possible. But the prosumer concept has to do with yourself as a consumer. Again, if your smartphone is near enough to you and you are conversing about a certain type of product, and then you suddenly see that there's an advertisement on the same phone, actually the recognition of the words that you've been using are not simply based on the trials and errors and of your speaking, but there are people who listen to these types of conversations, again, in contact centers, and are annotating and keeping track, so that then, in a way, AI, the machine, quote unquote, is trained. So the AI trainer become, in effect, are the people who are doing other kinds of work in the background. So this could also be in contact centers where labeling is occurring based on content moderation. And this is a whole kind of group of workers that during COVID, this became really a question, because people using social media, so the filters are not necessarily automatic. As is well known, there are content moderators who are having to look at the reported images or images that come through based on a list of standards, on a list of criteria, which are understood to be on this side of the screen, what I can see and what would not be permissible. Potentially, these are violent images, these are exploitative images in some ways. So content moderators will make the decision whether to take the image down or not. And they're working in highly surveilled conditions as well, whereby their quotas are very high, their ticketing systems, their abilities to even take toilet breaks, as is also well known in the Amazon warehouse space, they're limited. And so we started to really think through how human work is used in the process of this creation of supposedly this, you know, AI fantastic new, let's say, emperor, which is gonna create prosperity for the globe. And we started to question that and to look at who the workers are behind the scenes, allowing AI to exist, or the development of AI in the narrow capacity as it is now to proceed.
And just on that, how important are these people in developing AI?
Well, I would say very important. And the curiosity for me is that there are different types of, not just different categories for workers. So you have quite trained linguists who are working on training Alexa. So the question for me is the underemployment questions. There are highly educated, skilled workers who are actually often working in agency working environments. Sometimes they're working across Europe. They're migrants. They are not speaking the local language. So you have, for example, in this, so I mentioned Global South, and it does very much occur in the Global South. We've also found in my research that it's occurring in, for example, Berlin. There are 55 contact centers where this kind of work is happening, as well as the content moderation, where people who take the positions, and I wrote about this in my European Parliament report as well on surveillance, are recently graduated young migrant. And because they're not speaking German, this is the kind of job where they could, you know, they could easily start and, you know, work for a period of time. The issue then is psychosocial, because there's a whole dimension of stress because of the high working time, the pace that's required, the accelerated working pace because of the ticketing systems, as well as the nightmare around seeing for hours and hours on end quite violent or quite distressing images. So this is well documented. I would say important in the sense that this labor market is in no way slowing down. I would say it's capturing a pool of vulnerable workers, again, in both Global South and Global North. And it's something that will continue, I would argue, and because I do not think that all of text will be recognizable within the next, let's say, 10 years, and all images will be necessarily recognizable within the machinic sphere. But it's a very important part of the value chain, but yet one of the most distressing.
The way I look at this is that, as you said, obviously, probably over the next years, there will still be need for AI trainers to some degree. And there's some debate about how effectively you can, in principle, train content moderation systems to understand context. But the basic idea of what they're doing is that essentially AI trainers are training the AI to be good enough that they themselves are not needed. So they're effectively training themselves out of a job.
So during COVID, and this is something I started to talk about a minute ago, during COVID, because the nature of the security of the terminals that were being used by content moderators, they couldn't really work at home. So what happened was social media companies started to say, all right, well, we're going to increase the use of the algorithmic function, which is, of course, the semi-automation or full automation of that work. So what happened were increased numbers of images and other types of, so violent images, as well as other types of exploitative or distressing images. And that there was an increase in this, which made the news. And so the question, and it really occurred to me that this was an interesting testing bed for the thesis around the automation of the work that is happening in this kind of more circular or derivative sense. And so at the minute, people could be returned to the workplace they were, because that's what was discovered, that in fact the algorithms are very, very limited so far, and so the human work was still needed. But of course, it is the kind of work that should be automated, and a lot of work in factory environments, you know, there are exoskeletons being used now, but a lot of the work that occurs in the factory space, which of course is itself tracked, but maybe should be automated. But the other argument is that, in fact, the underpay, the casualization of this environment, the underemployment of the people working in these spaces, this is a labor market that is cheaper to hire than it is to, in fact, set up the machines and the algorithmic processes to substitute. So one of the arguments is, as long as there is a underpaid and underemployed working force and labor market to be exploited or to be used, then full automation is not likely to occur soon, even in situations where, frankly, it should. There should be content moderation done purely by algorithms because, again, of the nature of the psychosocial violence that content moderators experience. So, yes.
I really like the point that Phoebe made there. I think with all the fear of job losses and automation, there's a flip side which is less discussed, which is that there are certain kinds of jobs we really do want automated because they're unpleasant and take a real toll on workers. There's obviously a lot of complexity here. There's an ongoing discussion about how good you can actually make content moderation systems at understanding context. Now, AI trainers, that's obviously a job that in many contexts can be really unpleasant, and we would like that to be automated. And one underlying factor in how quickly the demand for AI trainers declines will be cheap labor. So the fact that if you have a ready supply of cheap labor, often gig workers, often from the global south, there's less economic incentive in terms of labor costs for companies to automate that kind of work. Now, if you'd like to hear more about this, we went into a lot of detail on that topic in our third episode in this series, Your Boss is an Algorithm. We'll be taking next weekend off, but the following week we'll be back with an episode all about algorithmic management and what it means for workers' rights. And please, if you enjoyed this episode, it would really help us out if you could share it with someone you think might be interested. We don't have any ads or make any money from this podcast. It's just about producing good content which people can learn something from, and we want as many people to benefit from it as possible. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again next time.